always thought that that music was too nice for dinosaurs. I'd like to see somebody write Christian words to it, and we could sing it in church. It's really that in The Planets, Gustav Holst, you know, the where the music, you know, some of the grand music there in Gustav Holst, I thought should have Christian words as well. Anyway, we're going to talk about design in nature. Design in nature. Every design requires a designer. If you found this watch laying outside on the sidewalk, you wouldn't mistake it for a natural object, would you? You would conclude it was designed. We take for granted the ability of recognizing designed objects from ones that occur naturally. Now, I saw we spent a lot of time in Australia. We took mission teams from Bob Jones University to Australia for 23 years. And I picked up a rock off the ground. It looks like an unusual rock. And somebody said, well, that's an Aboriginal axe head. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, it's possible. You know, it's, you know, I was not quite convinced of it and so forth. But for a precision device like a watch, we would say, yes, there was a designer of this watch. It was designed by someone with intelligence. It didn't arise by chance. So here's my watch, and here's my Aboriginal axe head. And so you can see my confusion about whether that was designed or not. I think it was an Aboriginal axe head, actually. So Isaiah 45, verse 18 says, "But thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." Notice he said he didn't make it in vain. Vain, that is, he had a purpose for it, and that purpose was for the earth to be inhabited. And so we should be able to look at the earth and the solar system that surrounds the earth and say, yes, this is more like a watch than a rock, okay? This looks like a designed machine, a precision machine. That's what we're going to talk about today. So you know about the global warming debate, unless you had your head in the sand for a while. And this is not controversial, this graph. This shows the global temperature anomalies over the last 100 years. And you can see that what we have is about 1 degree Celsius change in the last 100 years. And nobody reacted when I said that. You're supposed to say, only 1 degree Celsius in the last 100 years. Okay? Nobody still reacted. Anyway, so you understand what we're talking about is that God had to build this precision machine to keep the temperature from only going up 1 degree in the last 100 years. I mean, that's a remarkable thing when we think about all the energy inputs and outputs that had to be balanced for that to be true. Now, that 1 degree change has caused us a lot of trouble as far as the political world is concerned. I taught climate change and so forth for over 25 years at Bob Jones, and I taught it even before it was a political issue, okay? And I don't want to treat it as a political issue. So if you ask me questions, I'll express my response. But we need to show people, instead of talking about it on a political realm where we just talk past each other, we need to point people to the all-wise Creator God who designed this Earth solar system so that the temperature only goes up 1 degree in the last 100 years. And that's what we need to emphasize. So let's think about the amount of radiation arriving from the sun and the moon. The Earth, the only planet circling our sun at which life, as we know it, could and does exist. The Earth had a different mass, or traveled a little faster or slower around the sun, all life would cease to exist. The orbit of the Earth around the sun is almost nearly circular. It only has an eccentricity of 1.7%. And there's an extremely narrow range of possible temperatures and pressures and possible atmospheric composition and so forth that has to exist in order for to sustain life as we know it. If the Earth spun slower on its axis, we would all die. We'd be too cold at night, too warm during the day. And we see in Genesis 1:31, God looks at everything he made, and he said, "Behold, it was very good." It was very good. I had somebody ask me, some audience that said, "Well, how come he only says it's very good? How come he didn't say it was perfect?" And they were trying to, it was another raw site, and he was trying to say, "Well, see, there was already sin in the world." So he says it's only very good. He didn't say it was perfect. Well, the idea of perfection or completion, accomplishing what God intended the earth to accomplish when he created, that's included in the idea of very good. That's a sub-idea for very good. So very good includes perfection, all right? There was no sin at that point. Everything was very good. And then you have the diffusion of heat energy into outer space. Now, I see this graphic, and that looks fairly intimidating, okay? We'll have a test on that, you know, at the end of the hour, okay? You got to remember all those numbers. And I wanted it to look complex because I want to get across the idea that it is complex, okay? It's actually more complex than our computer programs can handle. Here we're talking about the reflection of incoming radiations, about 40%. The absorption by the atmosphere is about 20%. The absorption by land and water is another 40%. And yet of all the energy the sun gives off, only 0.45 billionth of its output is picked up by the Earth. 0.45 billionth. Why is that? Because the sun is so far away. It's 93 million miles away. That's exactly where we want a fusion reactor to be, as far away from us as possible. Okay, way out there, okay? So we only get a little bit of that energy. And unlike Jupiter that we talked about, the Earth radiates into space just about as much as it takes in, maintaining heat balance. This precise balance is responsible for the critical balance of forces that drive the hydrological cycle, rain, rivers, wind, glaciers, snow, so forth. And then we have the heat from the Earth's core that we have to, I didn't have a picture of the Earth's core, so that'll have to do. But we talked about this radioactivity in the Earth last hour. And so as it's producing those alpha particles and decaying and so forth, it's producing a lot of energy. About half of the energy in the interior of the Earth is from the original creation, and about half is from radioactivity. Lord Kelvin, who was a Christian man of science, he was very annoyed by Darwin's theory of evolution. He was annoyed by the long ages and so forth. He was the father of thermodynamics, thermo being heat, dynamics being motion. He knew that as you dug down in the earth, the deeper you got, the hotter it got. So he got in his brain, well, how about if the earth started off as a red-hot mass of metal and then cooled down to the temperature it was in his day? And he came up with various estimates of the top number of years it could have been there. So he came up with 20 million years. He came up with, if the earth cooled down from a molten lava to the temperature today, it'd be only 20 million years. Far cry from 4.6 billion years. But he didn't know about radioactivity. So if we did it with radioactivity, we'd probably have to double that figure, but still far below what we would expect based on the heat from the Earth. And that has to be balanced. That heat from the Earth has to be balanced as well. And then we have the conversion of gravitational energy to thermal energy. You have potential energy in rain and cosmic dust and so forth that's raining down on the Earth. That has to be balanced out. We have the kinetic energy produced by the tides. Okay, so not only does the water, you know, in the oceans, you know, go up and down, and then you have the waves, you know, splashing on the rocks, the waves hitting the rocks on the sides of the continents. Well, that's like setting off 3 hydrogen bombs every day. That heat has to be balanced. And then it's not just the water, but the ground itself is going up and down. Okay? And so those rocks are inside the earth grinding together, so you have a lot of friction. That has to be balanced as well. You getting the idea how complicated this is? Now, you know, we have these climate models that are going to purport to tell us what the climate's going to do in the future, but they're very similar to the kind of models we use for the weather. Okay? So you saw the weather today, and I think my weather forecast said it wasn't going to snow today, it was going to rain. Okay, that's what I saw. And so I was surprised to get up and find snow out there, okay? Especially being from South Carolina, I was surprised at the snow, okay? But if I told you it's going to rain or snow a week from today, you'd say, well, I'll wait and find out, okay? I'm not going to bank on that. If I told you it's going to rain or snow, you know, a year from now, you'd say, well, he's nuts, you know? He doesn't know that. And that's the trouble. The models can't handle all the data inputs. We don't have computer models that can tell us the future as far as climate is concerned. So in case there's any questions about that later on this hour, I am a global warming agnostic. First agnostic ever to speak from this platform. Okay. Pastor said that's true. Okay. So what I mean by that is I don't believe that science has the tools to be able to answer that question of how much the warming that is taking place, that 1 degree in the last 100 years, how much of that is because of man's activities and how much is because of, you know, natural phenomena and cycles that have taken place. Now think about it with me as from a Christian point of view. You have the flood, and so you have a lot of kinetic energy, potential energy turned into kinetic energy, so you have warm water, and then you have the fountains of the great deep are breaking up and putting a lot of ash up in the air, and so you have a lot of cold air because the sun can't get through. So you have a lot of cold air, warm water, and what do you end up with? You end up with big snowstorms. You end up with an ice age. And we can see where the snow started building up in the middle of the continents and went to the margins of the continents where the water was still warm. We see the scratch marks on the rocks because we know which way the glaciers were going. Started in the middle and went out. Okay, and then over 600, 700 year period, the water cools down. And the ice age ends, though in a sense, the ice age is still with us because we still have that big chunk of ice down in Antarctica. We have one up in Greenland, and they're still melting from the ice age. So the ice age still isn't over, okay, and they're still melting. So what would we expect as Bible-believing Christians? We'd expect things to be warming up since the ice age, and that's exactly what we've seen. Now, a lot of variations, oscillations, the sun has its thing, it has 11-year cycles and so forth. But overall, the general trend is for a warming Earth. Okay, that's what we would expect to occur. So that has to be balanced out as well. And then we have the enormous capacity of the Earth's oceans. Oh, I got to my slide too fast. We think about the Earth's oceans are 71% of the surface of the Earth. There's a lot of water there. It's still left over from the flood. If the earth was like a billiard ball, smooth like a billiard ball, the water would stand above the earth by a mile and a half. That's how much water is there. And that water has this very high heat capacity. Because of the hydrogen bonding, the water can store a lot of heat without changing temperature. That keeps the earth temperate. It keeps it from getting too hot or too cold here on the surface of the earth. God said he didn't create the earth in vain. He created it to be inhabited, okay? And this is one of the ways he did it. Let me demonstrate that for you. So I have here a mixture of isopropyl alcohol and salt water. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to set it on fire. Somebody said, how do you know if your ministry is successful? And I say, well, if the fire engines don't come, then it's successful. Okay? Any smoke detectors up there? Anyway, okay, here we go. So we're going to set it on fire. Okay? Okay, so the alcohol is burning. And the water protects the rag from burning because it has a high heat capacity, amazingly high heat capacity. The salt is there so you can see the flame. Normally we see flames because of soot particles heating up, but there's no soot because it's not burning. And so I wanted you to be able to see the flame. Otherwise, it's a very poor demonstration. Okay? And you see that the rag is not consumed. I'm trying to get it to stop. Stop burning. Stop burning. There we go. You want to hold on to that? This is my wife, Darlene. I'll stand next to you so they can hear you.
Okay. Tomorrow, we'll do more of this demonstration because there'll probably be more children here and they'll really be excited. But the next one that I'm going to do is he's going to set me on fire. And Ooh. After that, he might set the pastor on fire or okay. some other volunteer. Okay.
Well, we'll let the pastor delegate if he doesn't. I found out I had a pastor one time and he had a terrible accident when he was a teenager. And so he had bad memories of that. So he designated a deacon to do it. So That's fine. So we'll let him delegate that. So what I'm going to do is we have water here, and my wife Darlene is going to put her hand in the water and get it all wet, protect her, and then she's going to pick up some of these propane bubbles, and we're going to set her on fire. See? Like that. Pastor, you want to give it a try? Okay. Just pick the hand you don't use as much. Now pull your sleeve
out. Go up to your wrist. Make sure some extra wrist hairs up there get wet.
Yeah, we don't want to get... I got somebody's wrist hairs the other day. They're like little wicks. Here we go. Plays with your mind, doesn't it?
It does.
I had a seventh and an eighth grade girl out there fill the cards out, and would they like to come up and have their hands set on fire? Thank you for doing the cards. You gonna come?
All right, here we go. Here we go. Just don't tell child services. We'll be all right.
Okay.
Yep.
You sure you don't want to come,
sir? Okay. So water has a high heat capacity, which we just demonstrated. We'll talk about more of the unusual properties of water tomorrow morning for Sunday school. Let's get rid of that. That brings up the idea about precision. Now, when I was of constants, we talked about this earlier, we often talk about how the material things came about, the planets and the birds and the people and so forth. But how about all these constants? I was thinking about all the different constants that I taught when I was teaching chemistry and physics for 39 years at Bob Jones University. Gravitational constant, the speed of light, the elementary charge, Planck's constant, permittivity of free space, Stefan-Boltzmann constant, Rydberg constant, I go on and on. Each of these constants have to be exactly the value that they are with very little wiggle room or life would cease to exist. Okay. I was talking to a young man between sessions and we were talking about how the light got here from the sun and so forth, and one of the old creation theories that we've discarded, this idea that the sun, the speed of light has changed over time, okay, has decayed. But you can't do that. If you change the speed of light, it changes everything else, and life would cease to exist. James Clerk Maxwell, who was a great Christian man of science, Albert Einstein said that Maxwell was the finest mathematician of all time. And he was able to take the permittivity of free space, the permeability of free space, he multiplied them together, took the square root, divided by 2, he got the speed of light. He was able to calculate the speed of light 50 years before we could measure it. Yeah, pretty good trick, if you think about it. So it's actually, these constants are actually embedded in the physical universe that God created. So how did these constants, how did they become what they are today? Well, the secular scientists say, well, we live in a multiverse. That is, there's an infinite number of universes, and we just happen to live in the one, just by chance, that has all these numbers exactly right. Okay. Well, there's a problem with this. If it was all just by chance, that means that the guy who said that, all his thought processes are chance as well. Okay? And why should I have any credence in chance thought processes? You know, these electrons zinging around in his head and so forth in random ways. And so if we live in a universe that at the bottom is just chance, then we can't, there's no logic. There's no, we can't trust even our own thoughts. Not to mention the fact there's no evidence for a multiverse. And so whatever it is, we can't talk about in science, because science has to have at least some evidence for us to talk about it. And water is a miracle chemical, as we've seen. In Psalm 24, verse 1, it says, "The earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. For he hath founded it upon the seas and established it upon the floods." And just think about the fact that I put this phase diagram up here. That little diagonal line between ice and water is really unusual. Water in its solid state is less dense than it is in its liquid state. And because of that, ice floats. Now, if water was like every other substance on the face of the earth, and it was more dense when it was a solid, then the lakes and rivers would freeze from the bottom up. I understand you're the state of 10,000 lakes. I think I've seen 8,000 of them already. And what if all those lakes froze from the bottom up? Well, it would kill all the fish. Okay, but God in his wisdom made the ice so it's less dense. It forms an insulating layer over the lakes. And then you can go ice fishing. Okay, catch some of that aquatic life yourself. Think about the fact that the Earth is the only planet on which ice can exist in all three states under the conditions, the pressure and temperatures of Earth. Solid, liquid, and gas. All that is just remarkable. And then we have the existence of the north and south ice pole sheets, if melted, would submerge large amounts of land as well. And then we have the greenhouse effect. Now, the greenhouse effect gets a bad rap. But without the greenhouse effect, trapping energy from the sun, this long wave radiation from the sun, we would die. It would be too cold for life on Earth. So the greenhouse effect keeps us alive. Now, when I was teaching, I had a student from Guam, and I was walking around in a sultry South Carolina day, and she was in a car with the windows rolled up. And I tapped on the window, and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, Dr. Matsko," she said, "I was so homesick that I got in this car and rolled the windows up so it would feel like home." And I thought, I don't want to live in Guam. But that's the same kind of thing. It's that trapping of the radiation. And then you have the air currents that mix hotter air near the surface with colder air aloft by means of convection. This action not only maintains the heat balance, but also distributes oxygen and carbon. There's a little bit of scientific foreknowledge here. Solomon, Ecclesiastes 1:6, talked about these wind currents. Even we didn't figure these things out until the 19th century. "The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually. The wind returneth again according to his circuits." How did Solomon know that? Well, he was inspired by God. God knew about this long before science did. If you come across things in the Bible that don't seem to go along with what you learned in science, don't chuck the Bible out, okay? Bible's written by God, all right? We just haven't caught up. Science hasn't caught up to what the Bible teaches in many cases. And then you have the solar system's dynamic balance. Jeremiah 10:12 says, "He has made the earth by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom and hath stretched out the heavens by his discretion." The precision of the earth's orbit around the sun is just remarkable. How long does it take for the Earth to go around the sun? It takes 365 days, 6 hours, 9 minutes, 9.54 seconds. And how fast does it move? We're moving at 66,600 miles per hour. Can you feel it? You know, as we go around? No, you don't feel it, do you? Okay, so we're going 66,600 miles per hour around the sun. Now, what is the variation every year of the sun going, Earth going around the sun. How much does Earth, how much does a year vary time-wise? It varies by less than a hundredth of a second. Less than a hundredth of a second every year. The tilt of the Earth averages 23.5 degrees. That's why we have seasons. Okay? If the Earth was just straight up and down, all the water would freeze at the poles, and there'd be a big desert in between. Life would be impossible. We have to have the tilt of the Earth. And we'll see this afternoon, we talk about the moon. We'll see that the moon stabilizes the tilt of the Earth and gives us the seasons. That must be why God said he created the moon for seasons. How about that? Now, the Mars, for example, its tilt is about the same as ours right now. It's about 25 degrees right now. But it varies between 0 and 60 degrees because it doesn't have a large moon like ours to stabilize the tilt. So Mars would be a terrible place to live because it doesn't have stable tilt, therefore stable seasons. No surprise that the moon is exactly the right distance from the Earth. If the moon were closer, huge tides would overflow the lowlands. Moonlight and the moon itself are known to control the life cycles of many animals. And then the outer planets are found to be essential for life on Earth as well. We thank the Lord recently for Jupiter in your devotions. When you thank the Lord for things, you thank the Lord for Jupiter. Well, Jupiter and the other outer planets, they actually add energy to the inner solar system. You would think that, you know, because of all the tidal forces between the moon and the Earth, you would think that the Earth day would be getting longer. But no, it doesn't. It's very stable. We're only losing 0.01. Let's see, 0.01 seconds. You know, every year or so. And so, what keeps it stable? What keeps it is that Jupiter adds energy to this Earth-Moon system and keeps the system stable. Solar system stable. Now, the solar system is not stable over long periods of time. If you take all the planets, all the bodies in the solar system, you put them in a computer, we call this an orrery. An orrery is a computer model of the solar system. And you run them ahead a 500,000 years, they all crash into each other. And if you run them backwards by a 500,000 years, they all crash into each other. So the solar system is inherently chaotic in that sense. So we realize this is not the original design. We talked about this wonderful precision, but understand that we live in a world that's cursed by sin. It's not the original design, and so therefore we live in a chaotic solar system, and it's not stable for more than 500,000 years on either side. Isaiah 45 verse 12 said, I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and their host have I commanded. Okay, let me stop here and see if there's any questions that you have about any of this. Any questions at all? Yes, sir.
So you've mentioned a couple times about ice, and if I heard correctly, you mentioned the existence of ice following the flood.
Yes.
That is continuing to melt now in the present.
That's right.
Should we be concerned then about melting ice caps?
Well, if you live in a low-lying area, yes. So should we be concerned about melting ice caps? We know that if the Western Antarctic ice sheet, for example, melted, that the levels of the ocean would go up by, some estimates are 10 meters. So that's, you'd be in a problem in Florida, New York, Hong Kong, many cities in the world. So yes, that very well could happen. The Western Antarctic ice sheet is sitting on land. So if it slides off into the ocean, the sea levels could go up very rapidly. And underneath the Western Antarctic ice sheet are volcanoes, about 100 volcanoes under there. And so it keeps things all nice and warm and liquidy. And so they're concerned the whole thing's going to go into the ocean, and that could happen. Now, maybe that's something that's waiting for the tribulation period, or I don't know. But yes, that's certainly a concern. Okay, so if you really believe that the ocean levels are rising, okay, and I believe that they are, we have evidence of that fact, then I wouldn't build a fancy new house on the seashore, okay? I would move it back. And if you look at the hurricanes that we've had, we see that we've actually seen a small decrease in Category 1 through 5 hurricanes since 1900. We've seen a small decrease. But what we've seen a big increase in is property damage. Property damage has just gone through the roof. And so there's something wrong about our politicians saying they believe that the ocean levels are rising, and yet they build these fancy new houses on the seashore. There's certain hypocrisy involved with that, I think. Okay? So if we would just pull the flood insurance from the coastal properties, get everybody to move back some, that to me that would make a lot more sense than what we do now, is just seeing them all knocked down and build them up again using tax dollars. Okay? So that's my political opinion on that. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay. So, yes, the earth is warming up. And you can see it in the Bible. In Job, for example, it talks a lot about ice and snow in Job, more than almost any other book. Well, Job lived during the Ice Age, okay? So, and he lived in the Middle East. You wouldn't expect a lot of ice and snow if it was written today. You go to Paul. He lands on Mileta or Malta. And it was a jungle then. It's a desert today. And we have evidence, archaeological evidence, that the Sahara Desert was arable. They were growing things there. There were hippopotamus and alligators. We can dig them up in the sand there, and had a large population. So the idea that the way the earth is right now is the best of all possible worlds is just crazy. I mean, who's to say that that wasn't a better world? You know, Jason, the Argonauts, you know, you remember that? They were able to sail. If you read the Greek legend there, you can see they could sail from Greece through the Black Sea, through the Caspian Sea, through the Aral Sea. They sailed all the way to the foothills of the Himalaya Mountains. Well, right now, if you try to go there, you're going to have a four-wheel drive. It's all desert. It's all just sand, okay, and those stands, republics that are there. And so it's all dried out. And so we see the earth has radically changed just in a short period of time. The idea that somehow we're going to do something to keep it from changing is just nuts. That's all I can say. And you folks in Minnesota are going to be the beneficiaries, because you're going to be able to grow different crops if the Lord tarries. And people in Canada, they're going to benefit by it. Okay, so the world is changing, and we do what we always done. We adapt to the change. Okay, if you try to hold back the tide, there's not enough money in the whole world to keep it from changing. Okay, you can throw everybody out of work. We were in Australia, and the Australians got a carbon tax. And so what they managed to do with their carbon tax is they destroyed their whole cement industry. Cement kilns put out more carbon dioxide than almost any other activity. And so they closed down all their cement kilns, and now they buy all their cement from China. Well, China doesn't have any regulation of their cement kilns, so they're putting out 10 times as much carbon dioxide for the same amount of cement as they did before. So it doesn't make any sense on a political level or a scientific level or a common sense level. It just doesn't make any sense, okay? What makes sense is for us to realize that the earth is warming up and we need to adapt to it. Now, that's not to say there won't be variations. There is something called the Mauna minimum. Back in the 1680s, the sun went quiet because of the sun cycle. And the sunspots disappeared. And for a whole generation, it was colder than normal. We call it the Little Ice Age. And the Thames froze over. The terrible time because the crops failed and millions of people starved. Not a good thing. And it looks like the sun is doing the same thing now. Some scientists think that we might be in another Mauna minimum period starting 2020 next year. Other scientists say, no, it's going to be another cycle, 2030, that it's going to start. Okay, so we could have colder than normal temperatures for a whole generation. But the general trend has been warmer, okay, and drier, okay, in many places. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, that's right. So the volcanoes have to be taken into account as well that's adding heat to this system. That has to be modeled as well. And so God is, again, the fact that we've only seen 1 degree in the last 100 years is just absolutely astounding, even though you weren't astounded by it when I told you originally. It's absolutely astounding. And if you talk to people, you know, say that. We've only had 1 degree in the last 100 years. How's that possible? Well, it's because we have this wise God who made the earth so stable, even under the curse of sin, it doesn't get any warmer than that, even with all of man's activities. And let's point to the all-wise God. Yes, sir. Well, we have what we call proxy indicators, okay, where we look at like tree rings and ice cores and that type of thing that give us a longer range. Now, our time scale is different than their time scale, but we can see the general trend, you know, since the end of the ice age. Right, and that's true. We had the warming period during that time, and the Viking population exploded, and they pillaged their way, you know, through Europe and that type of thing because of the changing climate. And they went to Newfoundland. I took mission teams to Newfoundland, and they called it Vinland. You know, they grew grapes there, okay? So not like Newfoundland today. And so, yes, it's changed. But on the other hand, the general trend has still been, you know, to be warmer. So we have these variations, but the general trend has been warmer since the Ice Age. And that's what we'd expect as Bible-believing Christians. Yes?
Could you explain the Ice Age a little bit more as far as, like, when it started, when it kind of ended? What do you mean by in the age of ice?
Okay, so again, we have the warm water, okay, the waters that Noah's, you know, floating on the ark. They're warm because of all we have the kinetic energy produced from the potential energy going to kinetic energy. And so it's warmer, okay? And then you have the cold air because of all the volcanic activity. And so you don't have as much sunlight coming to the earth. So you have cold air, warm water, and that's why you get these terrific snowstorms. So it triggers the ice age. There's no current conditions that could give us an ice age, okay? There's no current conditions that could give us that big chunk of ice in Antarctica because it's the driest continent on Earth. It's a desert down there. So you can't build up miles of ice in a desert, okay? So that's all left over from the Ice Age. So the question of when it ended, we could say, you know, maybe creation scientists say maybe 600-700 years after the flood we're talking about. So from the flood to the 600-700 years after the flood. But in a sense, we're still in the Ice Age today because we still have those big chunks of ice still on the Earth. So it depends how you measure it. And so the water levels were lower. The animals and the people that were on the ark, they were able to expand all over the Earth. The kangaroos were able to hop down to Australia. They didn't have to cross water to do that because the water levels are lower. And then the water levels go up and the animals and the marsupials there in Australia are stuck there now, and they don't have to compete with placental animals that came later. Marsupials move faster because they carry their young with them, so they got there first. And the Paleo-Indians, they come across the Bering Strait. Again, the water's warm, so they could just walk along the shoreline. Okay? They didn't have, or they could take a canoe, they wanted to get all the way across. The secular idea about the Ice Age is that there's an ice-free corridor that opens up there in the middle of Canada down to the U.S., and you have ice walls on either side. If you ever watched the cartoon, Ice Age, you know, you ever watched, they show that. They show the ice on both sides, and they're walking, the mastodons are walking through and so forth. That's their idea. But that's just crazy, the idea there's this ice-free corridor in the middle of Canada. So no, they just went over the Bering Strait there. They just walked over to North America. Yes, sir.
Assuming the flood happened, would the evaporation of the water contribute to a lower temperature?
Well, it did evaporate and contributes to having more moisture in the air. So the warmer water gives you more humidity, And so then that gives you more snow, you know, these big snowstorms. So that's what we're talking about. So yes, it does. And so that helps cool things down. But it's such a large body of water, it just took a long time to cool down. And we look at the Ice Age animals that were trapped by the ice sheets. They got like up in the Arctic Ocean. They were pushed into smaller, smaller margins. And we find all these bones mixed together there in the edges where the Arctic Ocean is and where the ice sheet was. And there's warm weather animals and cold weather animals all sort of mixed in together, you know, because they were squeezed toward the coast as the water started cooling down. And so all the evidence we have, you know, shows this ice age that took place. Of course, you benefited here. You got your 10,000 lakes here in Minnesota because of it. Okay. Yes?
So a Christian worldview really should not be concerned with the concept of ice age.
No. No, there was an ice age.
The follow-up then would be, what does a Christian worldview need to be concerned about the concept of an ice age? So that the whole, I think this goes maybe a little to Dave's question. Dave's question defined for me the ice age, because I hear the phrase ice age used to support a secular worldview related to origins. How does a Christian worldview need to be concerned about the concept of ice age?
So they think that there are multiple ice ages over, you know, millions of years. And we only have one ice age. Okay? So the front of the ice sheet, you know, receded and came back and so forth, seasonally and so forth. So it wasn't just static. But where they see multiple ice ages, I believe without good evidence, we just see one. And that ice age is the direct result of the flood. So the ice age is evidence for the flood. Without a flood, you don't get an ice age. Okay, so ice age is evidence for the flood, not for evolutionary origins. Is that where you wanted to go with that? Okay. Yes. That's right.
So that's what, and as the water was evaporating, then there was more snow.
That's right.
Outside, so that, and that's more where.
That's right, more humidity. That's right, that's exactly. So like when volcanoes go off today, like Mount Pinatubo went off in Philippines, the whole earth got colder, especially in the northern hemisphere from the ash that was thrown up. When Krakatoa went off, they had a couple years without, you know, 2 years without summer, they called it, you know. And some of those volcanoes in Iceland caused terrible suffering, you know, as far as crop failure and that type of thing. So it still could happen today. In other words, so we're not talking about short-term things. We're talking about, you know, the long sweep of history here, okay? So volcanoes cool things down. They throw sulfate particles into the droplets, into the atmosphere, and sulfate particles absorb the energy very well, okay? And they block the sun. Okay, that's the problem that goes on there. Okay, good. Well, let's continue on. Those are all excellent questions. So I have three questions raised by the precision of the Earth and the solar system. The first is, how is it, as one author noted, that the entire universe is fantastically hospitable to life? The laws of nature themselves seem to be suited to the requirements of life. How did it happen? George Wald says, with what seemed to be so many other options, our universe came out just as it did. From our own self-centered point of view, that is the best way to make a universe. And that certainly is true, okay? That's not, you know, something that we just perceive. It actually is true. Secondly, if evolution works to evolve life to fit existing environments, why has it not equally conquered all the environments here and elsewhere? Several thousands of miles of changing environments from the center of the Earth to the edge of the atmosphere, only a few feet near the surface seem to be ideal for life. Why do you think the evolutionists are so interested in finding life on Mars? They're willing to spend your tax money to do it, because they want to show that life can arise easily in all environments. Psalm 115 and verse 16 said, the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth has he given to the children of men. That's We have to be here. If we're going to go anywhere else, we've got to take the earth with us. Okay, we've got to take the air and the water and the heat and everything else in order to survive anywhere else. And then, isn't it naive for me to argue that because the universe is hospitable to life, it was designed to harbor life? Isn't that like arguing like a flea believing that a dog's back was designed to harbor fleas? And yes, in fact, it's just like that. A flea is remarkably adapted to living on a dog in an incredibly complex way. And the flea's only habitat is on the skin of a habitable animal, and our habitat is only on the surface of the earth, unless we carry parts of it with us. So like many other symbiotic systems, it's actually an excellent argument for design. Which came first, the dog or the flea? I'll let you think about that. So I just want to end. Okay, we got that verse there. The heaven, even the heavens of the Lord's, the earth has he given to the children of men. I just wanted to end with Psalm 148. What does the precision design of the universe teach us about God and his creation? Praise ye the Lord. Praise ye the Lord from the heavens. Praise him in the heights. So everything in the atmosphere and above the atmosphere in space was created in such a way as being praised to God. We've seen that today. Praise ye him, all his angels. Praise ye him, all his host. So those creatures which inhabit a dimension different from our own perfectly fit in their environment as well. I assume there's angels here in the room with us today. We can't perceive them. I think they can perceive us, but they fit their environment as well. Praise ye him, sun and moon. Praise him, all ye stars of light. The heavenly bodies moving in their mathematical and precise orbits demonstrate the Creator's genius. Praise ye him, ye heaven of heavens, and ye waters that be above the heavens. Maybe, as Dr. Russell Humphreys maintains, that beyond the edge of the universe, there's an encompassing area of water, the waters above the firmament. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for he commanded and they were created. He's to be praised because he was able to speak the world into existence. He didn't require billions of years of trial and error to get it right. He hath established them forever and ever. He hath made a decree which shall not pass. So the stability of the universe is a thing to be wondered at and admired. Praise the Lord from the earth, ye dragons and all deeps. So even the prehistoric creatures and the bacteria found several miles down that live without air are not exempt from this majestic show of praise. Then we have the hydrological cycle, fire, hail, snow, vapor, stormy wind, fulfilling his word. So the hydrological cycle shows evidence of good planning. Mountains and all hills, fruitful trees and all cedars. So here's botany as well as geology. Beasts and all cattle, creeping things and flying fowl. There's biology. Kings of the earth and all people, princes and all the judges of the earth. So President Trump and Kim Jong-un, they're supposed to get in on this praise thing as well. Both young men and maidens, old men and children, so praise is equal opportunity for all. There's no ageism, no sexism, no racism. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for his name alone is excellent. His glory is above the earth and heaven. He has also exalted the horn of his people, the praise of all his saints, even of the children of Israel, people near unto him, praise ye the Lord. So I think the Bible is telling us that if you're not praising God for his creation, you don't know the God of creation. I think that's our conclusion. That should be our response this morning, to praise the Creator God. Okay, let's take a break, come back at 11, and we'll start on our next session.